Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode 125, Roscoe. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Andrew James Greger.
So Andrew James Greger is our guest today. He is the author of the novel, Roscoe. He is actually the second novelist we've had on the program, which normally talks to urbanists and architects. And of course, there is a big connection there. His historical practice is in architecture. He's a graduate of, I believe, the University of Oxford. Is that correct?
It's actually the Oxford School of Architecture, which is now Brookes University. It was not part of Oxford University itself. They didn't have an architectural school there, and I wouldn't have been smart enough to get in, I don't think. So,
but it very was, honest.
Allegedly, it was at the time the best architectural school in Britain.
Very good. So we're here today because of the relatively recent debut of the novel, which basically catalogs the story of an unhoused man who lives on the streets of San Francisco by choice. There's some shades of, I think, its author in the protagonist, which I think we'll get into. And I think it's a really interesting transition, and one that is interesting to me because, you know, my background is as a journalist and a writer, as is the case with Greg. I went on to study architecture and got a master's in architecture, but then failed to practice in any meaningful way and have been dancing around the periphery of the practice ever since. So your story is interesting to me, Andrew. Why don't you tell us how you got from studying architecture to practicing to becoming a novelist?
I graduated from what is now Brookes University in 85 with a postgraduate diploma in interior design, a postgraduate diploma in architecture. And then I worked for some guy in London who's had this new process for coding materials. I had no idea what I was doing. He had no idea what he was doing. He was a kind of a crazy genius. And I worked there for a year, and then I fell in love with a German girl, which means I moved to Germany, and I couldn't speak a word of German. And so finding a job was going to be hard, so I basically pretty quickly set up a practice of my own there. I learned German fairly quickly. I am a polylinguist. I speak Arabic as well. It helped very much with my German, funnily enough. Arabic is usually called the key to all languages. So because of the fact that you enunciate from all parts of your buccal cavity and your throat, there are all sorts of sounds, so you can mimic other languages. And what that meant was that within about 6 months, I spoke almost accent-free. I sounded like a German, but I had very little vocabulary and almost no grammar, so people thought I was just, you know, mentally disabled. I was walking around trying to make myself understood. But the short and long story is that I was there for about 18 years, and my practice thrived. We won some awards. I had 14 people working for me when I left in 2000, actually, or 2000. I then worked for another company that I founded, international company, and fell in love with an American girl. So I moved to America and Berkeley, California, actually. And there I was without work. The company I was working for went belly up. I started helping people out with their houses. You know, people would say, "You're an architect, you can do drywall, can't you?" And I didn't have any idea how to do drywall, but I figured I could do it. And so after a while, I just started charging for those services and became I founded a home remodeling company, which is around to this day. We still do that. I like building, my architectural background was almost coincidental, but I actually really enjoyed the subject, and I'm still fascinated by architecture around the world. Roscoe happened. It's my second novel, actually. I've been writing all my life. I've never had formal writing training, but I I wrote Roscoe. I woke up one day and just, I was almost homeless myself in 2010 or 2009, actually, when the crash happened here. There was no work. My ex-wife and I divorced. We're still friends, but we divorced. I found myself falling between the cracks here. I couldn't afford an apartment that I wanted to live in. They wouldn't rent me an apartment that I wanted to live in. And the apartments that I could rent, I didn't want to live in. So I started sleeping on friends' floors while I was looking. I got embarrassed about doing that, so I started sleeping in my truck. That got broken into. I couldn't afford the tag, so I started getting tickets for that. And the next step, you know, is the truck gets taken away, impounded, and then you've got no, you know, then you're at your last resort. You spend your last $100 on a tent, and you're outside somewhere in an encampment. And you know those short films of aircraft doing barrel rolls where they just about skim the ground or the lake or the water. That's how I felt. You know, I almost dropped into this. And you know, Roscoe was partly born out of that. I did a lot of outreach for the homeless after that, becoming aware of the rapidity with which one can drop into there. And my character, as you said, is unhoused by choice, but really the idea is that there is some mental health issues there that make a person choose that kind of life. That's why he speaks to himself or the audience. It's a first person novel. And it's he's very loosely based also on an unhoused man I met in Mainz in Germany when I was there, who was a professor of history, a very intelligent man, and really had apparently all his faculties, but he was the one who first told me I just had enough. I didn't want to be in the system anymore. I didn't want to be told what to do. I didn't want to be told what to teach. I didn't want to pay taxes. And I thought, screw it, I'm gonna step out of society. And there he was with his bicycle and his few things, and he said he felt freer than he had ever felt before. And of course, even then, I recognized that that's not a normal thing to do. When we grade normal as being a healthy thing to do, it's you're risking a lot of things. You're risking illness. You're risking all sorts of stuff. And so I recognize also there was a little schism within his own reality, maybe. But I also recognized that he was doing what he wanted to do, regardless. And it impressed me at the time. And that's kind of how Roscoe was born. And there we have it. There's the arc.
Well, that's pretty incredible. And I think it probably created a sense of empathy that you definitely see in the writing. I mean, Roscoe's a difficult person. He's definitely like, he has his wits about him. He's obviously intelligent. He's on the streets for a variety of reasons. And he definitely, you know, has his opinions, some of which are a little uncomfortable. It is
somewhat autobiographical, and friends of mine recognize me in there. And my spouse would tell you that yes, I am a very difficult person. You're absolutely right.
I mean, you know, he has some asides to himself where it's kind of like, well, yeah, I suppose I might have had that stray thought once in a while, but I don't think I would have expressed it to someone. But you know, at the same time, he's hyper-conscious of how he is perceived. And I think that that's something that, you know, is really interesting to read, you know, because we don't, I think we're, like, you know, in our profession and the profession that we talk about and around, you know, we're always talking about these crises in these abstract ways, you know, like how many more units can we get developed? How can we change policies? You know, but to hear it from in a sort of direct way of like, this is the daily lived experience of someone who's going through this. It's like that spiral that you described that you've nearly found yourself in. and I thought that it, you know, it was a really, it was a good demonstration of empathy. And even if sometimes dealing with his inner demons is uncomfortable to read, one of the things I thought was interesting and not surprising considering the author is that, you know, there is quite a bit of architecture criticism in his running monologue about a bunch of other things. But, you know, he talks about, you know, the Embarcadero Center and you know, Portman's interventions right there, down there at the foot of Market Street, which an area I know quite well. I quite like the Hyatt Regency. I know he hates it, and it certainly is an unfriendly building from the streetscape. No question about that. I wouldn't deny that. One of the things that I find interesting is that what he doesn't talk about, which I would have expected more because it's specifically aimed at the unhoused, which is the idea of hostile architecture, you know, specifically making benches and things that ordinary people are supposed to sit on, but homeless people are not supposed to sleep on. He actually doesn't talk about that much, but he does end up in a lot of places that are clearly not meant to be occupied. So you sort of, it implies that hostile architecture is forcing that choice. I'm interested in like your thoughts on hostile architecture and why that did or didn't make it into Roscoe's self-narrative. And Greg has a point.
Yeah, too. And to add to that, you know, what did you do in terms of research from the architectural side? Because it makes me think of Interboroughs like the arsenal of inclusion and exclusion, right? These documentations of all these different types of hostile architecture. So, yeah, how did you apply not just your personal experience of borderline homelessness, but also your architectural mind to how he interprets that?
You know, it did occur to me, and I've seen a lot of what you refer quite rightly to as hostile architecture. There is much less of it, in my opinion, in San Francisco than in other cities. You know, there are other cities that make sure the benches are impossible for a person to lie down on and things like that. And San Francisco there's a little bit of that, but does a lot less. And I really was trying to, this sounds a little wishy-washy, but I wanted to be kind of nice to San Francisco because it is one of the cities that makes a big effort to help the unhoused. You know, during COVID, they put them in hotels. They have mini showers for them in San Francisco. They've got little mini rooms for them and things like that. And I didn't want to just, I guess I didn't want to complain. I thought about bringing it up at one point, and then I dropped the idea. But you're right. It is, I mean, I think that in general, the city is not, you know, it's not built to have people sleeping around on it everywhere. And I suppose that it's something I could have done, I think, and I didn't. I missed out on it. So. That's a fair criticism, I think.
But I also like that he made it to the Clift, which is an excellent excellent hotel. He finds himself in very briefly. I won't give away too many spoilers, but he finds a sympathetic soul for a day or two or half a day, and finds himself in the Redwood Room there. I can remember going to talk to. Tech entrepreneurs there in like 2002, and so I was kind of remarking like, is that place still around? Like, that's wild.
Yes, it is.
And interestingly, I must say, I haven't personally been to San Francisco proper since before the pandemic, but when I was last there, the Clift was very much the Tenderloin seemed to be expanding, and the Clift was now sort of drifting into the Tenderloin. So that sort of bubble era Clift was sort of receding a bit because it was interesting how people perceived that hotel.
Yeah.
But sorry, Andrew, go ahead.
It has a personal attachment. I have a personal attachment to it. When I met my current partner, she took me to the Clift. I'd never been there. It was 2009, I think, or 2000, maybe 9, I guess. And I'd never been there. And I loved the atmosphere in there. And I thought it was, you know, this entrance foyer with these giant chairs and these weird things and this art. And the Redwood Room is spectacular. And so I was writing this and I thought, shit, you know, is it still there? And so I actually went over there just to double check that the Redwood Room still existed, you know, and it does, and it's still beautiful. And yes, the area, the tent, what you refer to as a Tenderloin, which is a a less attractive part of San Francisco, let's say, both socially and architecturally maybe, has expanded and is swallowing up those areas. There's a few things, but it's not too bad still in that part of the city.
So, you know, having Roscoe go through all of these, you know, difficulties that anyone who is unhoused and trying to maintain their dignity would go through in the streets of what is a comparatively forgiving city compared to, say, others in America, I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are on, you know, the doom loop that people talk about, which is, you know, this kind of repeating and seemingly worsening cycle that happened, you know, was triggered by the pandemic, where the particularly, you know, the Union Square area and maybe some surroundings, you know, businesses were closing, and then there was more people on the streets doing all kinds of things like drugs, and, you know, a mayor who was considered, you know, too accommodating of that, and now you've got a new mayor. What kind of, I don't know, what do you think some of the policy solutions might be that could help with the turnaround, which some people say has already begun?
Well, you know, I've been asked this a couple of times. You know, I'm not an expert on homelessness. I don't, I have almost been homeless. I've spoken to a lot of homeless people, and I'm not really in a position to criticize policies per se, because one of my very close friends is actually very, the mayor's right hand man, or was, you know, that it is very hard to enact policies that are gonna be kind to homeless people and also not create these these situations where you have these giant encampments, which are there, you know. That they often have signs there saying, "Where else shall we go?" You know, and I really, I'm very empathetic to their plight, because where are they going to go? But I do think that there are models in other cities that have been adopted, that could be adopted here too. Most of them are very, they're a little radical, and they're a little experimental. And I wish I could remember which city this was, but a city actually in a surprise, I think it may have been in Iowa, may have been in Illinois, somewhere like that. They started offering up empty apartments to the unhoused, with the premise that they would take care of the apartment, and as long as they took care of the apartment, they could stay there. And you know, the city spends an enormous amount of money trying to manage the unhoused in San Francisco. It's not just, you know, that they have an encampment, but you have to, there's cleaning, there's moving, there's, you know, there's the porta potties, there's all sorts of situations that the city spends money on. And this model actually had something like a 72% success rate, whereby somebody who was on the streets gets an apartment, they get some of their dignity back, they take care of the apartment, they finally find a job of some kind, and they don't have to pay rent immediately, so they're, you know, it's a process by which to bring them back into society. And I think that's obviously amongst the unhoused, there is, you know, maybe a third of them are drug addicts and need help, a third of them maybe have mental health issues and need help, and you know, a third of them are out on their luck. The rent rates are so high in the Bay Area. You know, somebody who's earning $70,000 a year is on the poverty line here, as you know. So, you know, I think that there are some steps that could be taken. And in my time, you know, I a lot of the vignettes in the book are actual stories that I was told. I used to give them, you know, a person on the street. Sometimes I'd buy them a meal. Sometimes I'd give them $10 and say, just, you know, tell me how you got here. And there's actually a channel on Instagram called Invisible People, which subscribe to. And some of the stories are, and they're often the same kind of stories, you know, people who've fell out. But my main belief is that as a society, which lives in a city where some apartments are selling for $4 or $5 million. I live in an area where houses here are selling for $5 million. It's insane. People are driving around in $3 or $4 million cars. I think a society that has that is actually has a duty to take care of people who cannot manage to take care of themselves. Historically, as humans, the reason Homo sapiens was successful and the Neanderthals less so was because we formed groups and we took care of people in those groups. Mary Leakey said, she was a friend of my father's when I met her, and she said the most important discovery she ever made was a skeleton of a female that was about 100,000 years old, whose femur, so upper thigh bone, had been broken and then been repaired. Which means that 100,000 years ago, we recognized the need to take care of those who could not take care of themselves. And, you know, throughout the Middle Ages, you had villages. There were mentally disabled people. There was the village idiot. There were people who were physically incapable. And the village would feed them and take care of them. The same as in Southeast Asia or Africa. Or, you know, that's a human thing. And this... This society that we've built now, which is very you're no longer really visible as a human being anymore in this mass of people. People don't know their neighbors. You barely know your neighbor who lives across the hall sometimes in an apartment building. And so I think that this feeling has been much more to retreat. And now with the internet, people are retreating even more into their own apartments. Everything's, you know, you DoorDash everything, you Instacart everything, you work from home, you know, and I really see it as a, I just had this kind of vision where suddenly the streets are kind of emptying of people who actually should be out there buying and purchasing and eating. They're receding, and we're almost left with just this gaggle of people who can't afford, you know, an internet connection or a phone or whatever, and are on the streets. And then we're like, you should take care of yourselves. You know, you should pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which is great, but it doesn't work if you don't have boots. You know, and I think that it's a very harsh society. America has this, especially amongst Republicans, America has this idea that nobody else should help you because it will make you soft and you'll rely on help instead of saying this person needs help just to get to the first rung of the ladder so you can start climbing again. I think it's about empathy and kindness and just being kind to people is something. I mean, I try and do a random act of kindness a day, you know, just pay for somebody's parking sometimes or pay for an old lady's shopping. I've done that. You know, it actually feels good. And if we could extend that and help people who are disenfranchised and struggling, I think it would be a better world than it is.
Andrew, what's your role? Bring this back to architecture in a way. What's your thoughts on the roles of architectural and urbanist practitioners in this regard? You know, there's lots of discussions about the cost of building dedicated housing for the unhoused, but then also, I think about my friend Rafi Siegel, architect, has a great line that the hallmark of modernism is that the state was the client. And so you had a strong state, you had investment in exactly those kinds of facilities. We live in a time where, of course, the state is no longer the client. So, you know, does design have any agency in this regard? Or is it really, it's just sort of downstream of all of these problems? Because architects would like to think they can contribute to this. And in many ways, without that kind of state institutional support for this, it's hard to imagine what really those viable paths are. But I'm curious your thoughts of practitioners.
I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure I'm that qualified to answer it, but I really feel that one of the hurdles is the organizational side of it. If you wanted to, as an architect, contribute, and I think we could, as builders and architects, we could. I actually started just before COVID, funnily enough, I had I had a couple of people that I wanted to start trying to find a way to build tiny homes for the unhoused somewhere out there with compostable composting toilets and somehow running water. We had this vague plan. We started putting together a kind of business model, but we got caught up in so much red tape, and then COVID hit, and the red tape comes around like, well, where are we going to do this? Where are you going to build it? Where are you going to put the houses? And how should they look? And who's going to help? How are you going to get through planning? That kind of thing. You know, it's really hard as an individual, or even and I have another issue, which is a personal one, about this, and that is that, a long time ago, I'm a huge advocate for animals. I try not to eat them. I want to save all of them, and a while ago, this pertains to this in a way. A while ago, I was making myself wrong because I had people I knew who set up 503 nonprofits to help dogs or cats or the orangutans in Asia or something, and I was like, why can't I do this? And I realized that they were solely focused on that. And I am completely scattered. I want to save everyone, everywhere, all the time. And so this effort, which was hampered by COVID coming, never got started up again, because now I'm trying to think of, how am I going to help dogs in Bali, because they need help. But I think it's a really good question. I think that if somebody were to get up and, maybe that could be me, I don't know, and bring together a bunch of, a group of architects and builders to actually form a group that would then go to the city. And like you said, it's the city is no longer the client. But if you went to the city and said, look, we're ready to do this. We have a plan. We want to execute it. And a city like San Francisco might well say yes. And maybe that's your question is maybe an impetus for me to not just write about it, but to go and do something. So now I'm thinking maybe that's it's a very good point.
There are actually some collectives, and they're based in places that have a lot of these types of problems. You know, like I think about our friends, Matthias Ekanov in Mumbai, for example, where they've basically just kind of looked at the ways that historically people have operated without much state support, and tried to take advantage of, vernacular ways of building, vernacular ways of occupying buildings that were intended perhaps for something else. Some might call that squatting, but, it's kind of but it's mediated through, an actual architectural practice that brings basic services. And there are examples of collectives that have been able to do this in some very difficult working circumstances where the machine of the state, ostensibly wants to solve these social problems, but their solution is always to just clear everything away and build something completely new on top of it, which is like that sort of the modernist approach. But it sort of seems to me that if anything's going to change, it almost has to, you have to deal with what's right in front of your face, right? And I think everyone has a local problem, and you've demonstrated this in your own work and your own just perambulations, right? Like going around and talking to people, as much as it might, as Westerners, feel like an obligation for us to solve the problems of the world, someone, an animal or a human who's suffering in a place on the other side of the world, collectively, yes, that should and could be our problem. But where we can be most effective probably is where things are right under our own noses, right? And I think that's probably, again, I'm speaking even more out of school, but that's probably where I would start, right? Is kind of thinking about, okay, if I go in a 5-block radius, what are the social problems that I see, and what are the apparatuses of the municipality or the state that affect the outcomes for people who live within that radius, and start working out from there. Maybe that's the way to do it.
Well, I think your point, meshes in with what I was saying before, that that there, the squatting thing without it being squatting, but there are apartments and buildings that are unoccupied in San Francisco. There are fewer than other places, but they are there, and that could be something, you know, like I said, like the model of this this other city. I don't think it was Des Moines, but it was somewhere like that, where they then. You know, and there would have to be some kind of triage, because obviously there's, you know, as harsh as it is, there's little point giving that to somebody who's a heroin addict and full blown, you know, shooting up every 4 hours or something, trying to give them an apartment, because it's not going to work. But there are a lot of people. One of the stories that I remember was when I was driving in Oakland, I was passing a small encampment, and I was stopped at the traffic light, and what I noticed was, you know, there was a normal encampment, and then there was this one tent, and it was brand new, and it was orange, and outside it this girl, maybe was in her mid to late 20s, this woman, maybe I should say, and she was sweeping the ground in front of her tent. And you know, Hemingway was always able to make a whole story out of just a few words. And in that moment, I sort of, and I may have been wrong, but I saw her story. You know, she just moved in. She just got her tent. It was brand new. She still thought it was temporary. She was sweeping the ground in front of it. She still thought, okay, I'm going to do this for a few weeks or a couple of months, and then I'll be back on my feet. And of course, that's, you know, this vortex that is this whirlpool of, that you get, you know, suddenly she's not on her feet, and suddenly, you know, she's amongst the crowd that, you know, are going to just slowly devolve into drug addiction, because drugs is a good way to beat reality sometimes. You know, it's this is a harsh world, and I personally, I do not have anything bad to say about somebody who takes drugs just to deal with reality, with what we've got going on today. I wish they would find another way, but I can't blame them personally. But I just saw her life, you know, just that moment in her life. It was a split second in her life, and I always wondered, did she get herself out of there, or did she not? But I guess, coming back to what you said, like, that would be a candidate for somebody to say, look, we're going to set you up in an apartment, you know, you take care of it, you find some work, get back on your feet, you know, and if they don't, then they get asked to leave. But it's, like I said, there was something like a 72% success rate, which is huge. That doesn't mean that 72% of all the homeless people were back on their feet, but of the people they put into these apartments, they just give them back some dignity, give them back a purpose, give them back a reason to actually get work, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a myriad of you know, solutions that have been attempted, and I think it's highly contextual to the circumstances of the local municipality, you know, whatever overlapping regulations there might be, whatever the local housing market is like, they're all going to affect. It's probably unlikely that there is one surefire model that, otherwise we would have implemented it by now, right? Yeah. I'm curious about, you know, with you now taking this book on the road and having this be a bigger part of your life, what do you see as what do you want to affect with it? What kind of effect do you think that it's having on people? How has the reception been? I don't know how long it's been out, but it sounds like you're getting some recognition for it.
So it's been out since the beginning of May. It was awarded the Golden Quill by Reader's Reviews. It was awarded a gold badge by the Literary Titan. It won the first place in the New York Book Festival, which I'm really proud of. It just came runner-up in the Hollywood Book Festival. So it's getting some traction, and my aim really was to bring about the idea that people can, you know, these are humans and you can talk to them and they have something to say and it's worth giving them a few moments of your time. I think, you know, Greg's question before was really valid, and I think it's part of this idea that maybe it can, you know, I understand that I'm kind of, I sound like a megalomaniac now, but I would love this book to actually generate an interest in a societal interest in helping to try and make this a slightly less a smaller problem than it is, let's say. I'd like the homeless to not be seen as a problem, but as a product of the society that we built, and that we have a duty to also try and solve it by taking care of them and appreciating the fact that they're human beings who are doing their best a lot of the time.
It's a difficult thing, particularly in the States, given even successful accounts become individual ones. I'm reminded of Patrick Feeley's amazing piece for Esquire, The Invisible Man, about his firsthand account by a former journalist who now is unhoused. And yeah, it was a 9,000 word sensational piece. He got a GoFundMe, he got housed, he was individually saved, but you know, but then that just becomes a singular moment for that. It's very hard to break through from a policy. So I hope you have more success.
Talent to write that, so you know that's not everybody's thing. You know, I've told on several podcasts, I've told this story that was really important to me when I first came to this area. I've been coming to the States all my life. My aunt lived in Louisiana, my father lived in Ohio for reasons that we won't go into right now. The two places in the States I would never choose to live in, but there you go. When I first came here, I was walking out of Whole Foods, and a man who was panhandling, you know, asked me for some money, and I completely ignored him because I had no money on me. I just walked straight past him, and he yelled at me, and he said, "You could at least say hello," or something like that, you know. And I was so ashamed, and I turned around, and I talked to him for about 30 minutes, and then I went home, and then I got some money from my then wife, and I came back and gave him a $10, and I said, "I'm really sorry for having ignored you." And since then, I have never passed another homeless person without not acknowledging them. Even if you don't have money, you can just say, "I'm really sorry, I don't have money. You know, I wish you luck. Hope you get off the streets." You know, you can say something. You can do something, and that was one of the things that has always stayed with me, and which prompted me to write this as well, to just acknowledge that these are people who want to be treated with some dignity and some respect.
I wonder too. I mean, I know, so you've clearly got the vehicle with the book, and it sounds like it's getting some recognition through publishing channels and the publicity that surrounds that. I'm wondering if in your daily architecture work, or maybe you've stepped back from that a bit, if you find ways to work in this encouragement of empathy, or even to try to, I don't know, set up donations or something. But clearly a lot of your clients would be wealthy enough to do home additions and renovations in the Bay Area. So, I mean, has there been a way to introduce that into the conversations you have with clients?
You know, I'm going to talk about my clients directly, but the construction here is horribly expensive. What I've found is the people with the most money are the ones who are the least willing to spend it on anything. You know, we work sometimes for people who are on a tight budget, and they don't have that much money, with a school teacher and a landscape designer who's not doing great. They're the ones who then say at the end of the job, "This is so great, we love this, we're gonna leave you a tip." Part of the idea behind that, when we were gonna, you know, put together this idea to build tiny homes in San Francisco, I had this idea of telling clients, look, I'm going to charge you this much. You know, 1% of it is going to go towards this charity. And maybe I could start that up again. When COVID came, COVID was financially disastrous for me as a builder. I lost a lot of money, and as a result, I never really, until about a year and a half ago, I was very much in debt myself, and so thinking about, going down that route was not part of it. It was really about trying to rebuild my firm, which is now doing well again. We do basically residential remodeling as a whole, and some of the jobs are $600,000-$800,000 or $1 million or something, and you think there's enough slush fund to feed into that, and maybe there will be, but up till now I've been really just serving myself to get myself back out of debt and not back on my feet, but it's certainly a good point. And like I said, back in 2019, when I had this idea with these two friends, that was one of the things where we said, look, we can divert some cash into this, the company can pay for it, we can buy materials, we get discounted materials, I have my crew. We used to do, there's an organization in Berkeley called, I think, Building Together, that has funds to go and help people who are who don't have the money to fix their roofs or fix their electrical and we did that with them for a while with my whole crew. So we'd spend 4 or 5 days as a company working on somebody's house, repairing the stucco, repainting, fixing decks, fixing stairs, putting handrails up, that kind of thing. And that's, that was something, it didn't specifically address the unhoused, but that's also a mechanism by which that could possibly work. It's a very good point.
Yeah, it's so difficult when everyone kind of at their own scale feels like they're struggling, right? Yeah. It's like, yeah, we can't squeeze any more out of this construction budget. And you can't really have a conversation with a client where it's like, well, have you thought about just taking all the money that you were going to do in this renovation and make a living for me and just putting that into some kind of vague, affordable housing program that might get one unit built for someone you don't know? That's a tough ask.
It is. Especially,
it's a tough ask.
It is. Yeah.
It sort of seems like the compromise here, or the way to best leverage the fact that you've invested all this effort in your business and in this book, is to kind of just raise awareness through the activities, that you undertake with both, right? It's kind of like, rather than saying, well, can you make this donation? It's kind of like, did you see that I wrote this book, by the way? Just read it, think about it, think about what you could do. Maybe that's the best you can do at this point.
I have actually, I do tell people that, that I wrote the book, and I do tell them that if they buy it from me, that I will donate that money to one of the organizations that are involved.
Andrew James Greger, I really want to thank you for joining us today on Unfrozen. Andrew is the author of Roscoe, a novel about an unhoused person in the Bay Area, and he is an architect and renovator with a company called Blue Dog Renovation, he's doing the good work out there. So thanks again for joining
us. Thank you, Danny. Thank you, Greg. And if you guys have any ideas, send them my way. I'd love to, collaborate to try and get something done someday. It'd be great.
I will add for listeners, we'll put the link in the show notes for urbanists in the New York area. One of my heartiest recommendations is that in late January, you sign up for HOPE, which is the Homeless Outreach Population Estimate. It's a survey that's done in real time, overnight in New York City, which basically goes towards creating the data set that wins HUD funding under the McKinney-Vento Act. So it's also a fascinating time to really reflect on these issues with other fellow urbanists and city employees. And so we'll put a link in there. But that's one of my favorite ways to volunteer for exactly around these issues, and hopefully other cities do the same. So thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, guys. Stop with no one to stay.